call the tax committee to order. Senator Betzel, I was going to have you up first, but our Senate counsel slipped out on us, so we're going to get started with a presentation by Richard Sims. I asked him to come and talk to us about how business taxes might impact future economic growth or maybe personal income in the state, because I think we're all concerned that we don't want to do anything in Minnesota that hampers our economy in the future. So he's done some research on this. I thought it might be helpful for members to see that as we move forward this session. So, Mr. Sims, could you join us, please?
They got to get a big name. We can read that little name.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Richard Sims, president of the Sierra Institute on Applied Economics. By way of a 10-second introduction, I've worked for on the staff of state legislatures in several states around the country and a couple of foreign governments, helping them implement taxation and economic development programs. And I have frequently been asked questions on how do we fund public services without choking off economic growth that funds the resources for those services. And what I've done over the years that I want to share with you today is put together some information that looks at the actual numbers behind what happens when states change their tax structure and change their spending structure, because as everyone in this room is well aware, you have a balanced budget that your taxes and expenditures have to go lockstep hand in hand. When you raise taxes, that means you have more money to spend. When you cut taxes, you have less to spend. The question becomes, what's the net balance on the economy when you invest in public services but have to at the same time fund those through some sources such as raising taxes? A first principle of public finance is your tax system should look like you did it on purpose. Quick look at the Minnesota tax system. This is the result of the Minnesota tax system that shows taxes by income category, the tax contribution by people according to their share of income. And I haven't updated this. I just have seen the most recent numbers, I think, just came out in the last couple of days, updating this information, which I don't have incorporated for Minnesota yet. But the pattern is going to look similar, that you're fairly similar across income ranges with a slight downtrend when you get into the upper income categories, pay a little less of their total income in total state and local taxes than do people at the middle and bottom ends. A contributing factor in this shadow in the background, I've tried to figure out how to show the effect of federal tax deductibility as well on there. This declining shadow in the background shows what households at various levels pay after they're able to deduct their state sales tax, income tax and property tax from the federal taxes for those that itemize. The effect comes out to be that households at the bottom end, your lowest one-fifth of the population in Minnesota, pay about 10.5% of their income in total taxes. Those at the middle, about the same level, and those at the top level pay about 9.5% before federal offset, but dropping down to about 6.5% after federal offset. So your system is tilted somewhat towards putting more of the burden on those at the lower end of the income ranges rather than at the upper end of the income ranges. And in fact, some of the changes that you've made over the last decade or so have cut the taxes at the upper end more than you've cut taxes on people at the lower end. In fact, many households at the lower end have had increases because of increases in fees and excise taxes. When you increase the cigarette tax, for example, which, regardless of what you think about cigarettes and smoking, has the effect that low-income households tend to be disproportionately burdened by a cigarette tax. The cigarette tax, they say in economic circles, is a tax on people who can't read the Surgeon General's warning. That tends to be a tax that's paid by people at the lower ends. And while it does raise revenue, it doesn't grow very fast. And it disproportionately falls on lower income households. This links into your overall tax system. It matters how you tax. What I have on the screen shows the elasticities of various taxes, meaning how they grow over time as the economy grows. For example, the first tax shown up there, the personal income tax, you see has a number of 1.03 beside it. What that means is when the economy grows 1%, the personal income tax grows 1.03%, so a little faster than growth in the overall economy. All of the other taxes that you have at your disposal, the corporate income tax, sales tax, property tax, cigarettes taxes, lotteries, and so forth, all grow at rates less than growth in the economy. So for funding public services, this says that the more you depend on what the economists call inelastic taxes, taxes that don't grow as fast as growth in the economy, each year you're able to provide a little less in public services as a share of the economy than you were the previous year. The only one that does grow as fast and slightly faster, again, being the individual income tax. Looking first at business taxes, I was asked by the National Government Association a couple of years ago to look at how business taxes relate to growth in the economy. Here on this chart A is the 10 fastest growing states in the nation, and a look at their corporate income tax rate. Fastest growing state over this 10-year period was Wyoming, which has no income tax. Second was D.C., which has almost a 10% rate, North Dakota at 10.5%, Vermont 9.75%, Massachusetts 9.5%, and so on. The average tax rate, corporate income tax rate for these 10 states was just over 7%. Chart B shows the 10 slowest growing states. The average corporate tax rate for the slowest growing states was 6.25%. In fact, the slower growing states had lower tax rates than the top growing taxes. We note, incidentally, that over the previous 20 years or so, corporate taxes as a percent of corporate profits have fallen by about 50%, while taxes on individuals have risen. You see that here in Minnesota, that the taxes that you get from businesses declines each year as a share of your total general fund revenue available. That's been in part because of tax cuts and tax breaks, and it's in part because corporations are putting more resources into tax planning, into passive investment activities, that helps lower taxes in one state and shifts the liability to other states that have lower rates. There's a chart.
Mr. Simpson, yes. Senator Ortman.
Can I just take that last chart?
Sure.
Part of that might be attributable to the fact that we've changed the corporate structure as well, taxing individuals more through partnerships and other types of formal arrangements as opposed to in corporate formation.
There is some part of that, and it affects a lot of corporations. It doesn't affect a lot of the dollar amount of corporations, because out of the total corporations, probably the majority of corporations that would have been incorporated in Minnesota 20 years ago are now have reincorporated as LLCs or other corporate forms. So they've fallen out in numbers of corporations, but all of those together represent only a fraction of what one manufacturing firm, for example, would represent. So it didn't change the total tax collections, but yes, that was one factor. The other big factor is 20 years ago, corporations were not using passive investment activities where a firm such as a Toys R Us or a Starbucks would incorporate the name of that firm into a Delaware corporation and would be able to each year send a check for the fair market value of the right to that name to their Delaware subsidiary, which becomes a deduction against Minnesota taxes. It would be taxable in Delaware, except Delaware doesn't tax non-state corporations, so it becomes an essentially nowhere tax. Looking a little more broadly at taxes, each year you probably get information from the Tax Foundation. They do an annual ranking of the state business climates. I've looked here at the 10 most business tax-friendly states, South Dakota being most, Florida second, Alaska third, and so forth. And there's my PowerPoint jumped to the point. That should be 3.4 rather than 34.2. Got a decimal off on that. But of these top-ranked states, the 10 states with the most friendly business climate, their average income increase, growth in the economy over the previous decade, was 4.2%. Compared to the 10 least business tax-friendly states, according to that ranking, 4.2%. So exactly the same growth rate, whether you're business tax-friendly or not business tax-friendly, didn't seem to affect performance by that measure. There's another ranking that comes out that your commerce people get each year. When I was with state governments, we used to wait for this with bated breath every November. We didn't have a lot to look forward to in those days. This report that comes out of Site Selection Magazine, that's the trade journal for business relocation people that advise businesses on where to locate and pick sites for them, do a survey that ranks the states according to their overall business climate. This includes taxes plus regulatory issues plus labor issues, all of the things that they feel like business would look at when making a location decision. Of the 25 most favored states, North Carolina was the most favored state in 06, followed by Texas, Ohio, Georgia, Indiana, Kentucky, Tennessee. If you then look at how these states actually perform in terms of their economy, the chart on the right shows North Carolina, most favored in the country, actually grew at 39th in the nation. Texas did okay. Number two state ranked Texas was 12th in the nation in growth. Ohio, 47th, Georgia, 43rd, Indiana, 46th, Tennessee, 37th, and so forth. Note that you have to get down to the bottom of the chart, you, in fact, at 23rd in business climate to get a state that's in the top 10. Only Minnesota and Oklahoma of the top 25 ranked states were even in the top 10 in terms of economic performance. What we found over the years is that the things that give a state a good business climate actually are correlated not with economic growth, but with slow growth in the economy. That these factors that we tend to strive after in our economic development offices aren't associated with growing economies. One reason is that corporate taxes don't vary all that much, that they tend to cluster around 7.5% is the U.S. average. Two-thirds of the states are within about 1.5% either way of that average, so there's not a lot of difference there. Remembering also that state taxes are deductible against federal taxes, so that reduces the difference by about another third. And note from this chart that ranks all the states according to their business tax. Minnesota up here is in this group of states that have over 9% tax rate. The average growth in this group that had over 9%, you'd have a hard time reading it in the back of the room, it came out to 4.6%. The average growth of the states that had 6% or below was 4.2%. So the states that were up here, the relatively high-taxing states, grew faster than the states that are down here, which is counterintuitive at first blush, but there is actually a good, valid reason behind that. This is the reason in part. This chart, I went to the U.S. Department of Commerce and looked at their national income and product accounts. It gives detailed information on exactly how all firms in America spend their money. State corporate income taxes, on average, come out to 0.25% of total business spending. Compare that with direct labor cost, which is 48% of total business spending. Productivity and things related to labor are what business makes their decision based on. That's where their profits come from, is increasing labor productivity. This gets back to answering the question of why low-tax states tend to grow slower. They tend to have low taxes, but those low taxes show up in the form of lower productivity in their workforce. When firms were asked by the U.S. Federal Reserve, what do they consider in making relocation cost? The Federal Reserve looked at 4,200 firms in America, major firms, that had made a relocation decision over a 10-year period. Of the manufacturing-type firms, labor was 36% of the reason. That was the biggest single reason they gave. Transportation was about the same at 35%. On down the list, taxes were about 4% of the factor. For office-type firms, those are the high-tech firms that most states tend to want to attract, the relatively clean firms with high wages, the office-type firms. They report that 72% of their reasoning for relocation is to be near better quality workforce. That's the single factor that they look for more than anything else. Taxes were 5% of the reason they considered, against 72% for labor. When we've looked at, so far I focused on business taxes, we've ran these same numbers looking at taxes on individuals. And you get a similar pattern that says states that grow the fastest tend to have above average taxes. States that grow the slowest then by definition have lower taxes. There were some no income tax states. There are 9 states that have no income taxes. 4 of them were ranked fast growth, but 4 of them were also ranked slow growth. So there's no correlation there. I was also asked by the Governors Association to say, well, what about taxes on high income individuals? Maybe that's who makes location decisions, are the CEOs that are in the $500,000 and above category. What we find is the states that have the highest taxes own people at the $500,000 and above income thresholds grow about 25% faster than the states that have the lowest taxes on high-income households. All this is not to say that businesses or individuals prefer low taxes. It is to say that they prefer public services that are somehow associated with those taxes. They tend to go hand in hand, and that it looks like from the evidence that they tend to locate where they can get quality public services, even if it means having to pay higher prices in the form of taxes. I was also asked to look at what happens when a state goes from a no-income tax situation to adopting an income tax. That seemed to be a pretty good test of what that means for the economy, going from a situation where you have no income tax at all to an income tax that looks somewhat like the rest of the states. Over the period starting in about 1971, this chart shows, and that again will be hard to read, but I'll make all this available to you. I looked at the states that implemented an income tax for the first time. The net result of this analysis was that the states that went from having no income tax to having an income tax in place grew faster than their historic trends and grew faster than the other states in the years following the adoption of their income tax, that it actually contributed to growth as opposed to retarding growth, as you might initially expect. But we're kind of intuitive to think that small government and low taxes lead to economic growth. But in fact, that doesn't seem supported by this data or by international comparisons. For example, if we look at there are 28 industrialized nations of the world. This chart shows those nations according to the percent of their economy that goes to taxes. The nations on the right over here, Mexico, Japan, Korea, and the U.S. On the left, we have Sweden, Denmark, Belgium, Finland, Norway, Luxembourg. In terms of growth, Luxembourg, Norway, Finland, the Scandinavian countries tend to cluster at the high end of the growth charts. Mexico was bottom on taxes and also bottom on growth. Switzerland, Japan, France, U.S. was about in the middle on this. We were again getting the results were the opposite of what you would intuitively expect, that the higher taxing nations tended to grow faster than the low taxing nations. One reason, again, when we've surveyed businesses to say, why do you pick a city to locate in? There's a group in D.C. called Capital Access Corporation that's a business-funded organization that had wanted to know what cities could do to make themselves more attractive. So they asked their membership, what could a city do to make you want to invest more there or to relocate there? Their answers were, as I've ranked these, the number one answer was education, education, education. You've heard the real estate adage, location, location, location. This is slightly different in that this first education, according to their survey findings, was K-12. This second education was Votech and Community College, and the third was higher education. So actually the number one, two, and three items that they said would make it more attractive were, again, these workforce issues. That was the point, was we need a better quality workforce, both directly, so we can hire better laborers, better workers. We also need a better quality education system so that we can attract existing workers who want to live in a community that has a better school system. They also reported that speeding up the permitting and process for receiving regulations and permits be improved. That's always a concern. Cities and states need to look more at one-stop shopping for regulatory permitting so that people trying to start a business don't have to go all over town or all over the state trying to figure out how to get a new business going. That was a big factor. The group asked its members about tax incentives. We got an interesting answer. The group said, we love tax incentives, but we don't make decisions based on them. That we make our decisions based on market factors, the nearness to resources, the nearness to customers, the nearness to a transportation infrastructure. We look at those things, and then if they happen to offer incentives, we feel that's a cost savings to us, but that's not a consideration on making the initial location decision. That was kind of surprising to us. On the other hand, if we look at states that invest the most in education, this chart shows both the top 10 states that spend the most per capita for education, K-12, and the states that spend the least on K-12 education. Those high spending states had a growth rate of 4.3% over the last decade. The bottom spending states had a growth rate of 3.8% over the last decade. Now, to an economist, a difference of a half a percentage point over a decade, annual growth rate, is a very substantial change in growth. That's a big, big difference. These states that were the most high spending also tended to be the fastest growing. Now, again, none of these are sufficient to explain the full answer to why states grow. Alaska, at number one in spending, also has the advantage that it's the number one oil-producing state, so it can raise a lot of money for education without taxing its own individuals. Minnesota doesn't have that that good fortune, as most other states don't. But the general pattern that we see again is that states that spend relatively high for education tend to be more attractive than the states that that rely on other things to attract business and economic growth. I was doing a totally unrelated study recently for the Higher Education Commission on the states, and I noticed that Minnesota stood out of my 50-state comparison in its brain magnetism. You were one of the highest states in attracting educated individuals. Over the last 10 years, from 95 to 05, Minnesota attracted 148,000 more bachelor's degree holders than you produced. Very good sign. This says that in the marketplace, when you look at where people actually vote with their feet, smart people like to live here. Not just people that were raised here, but people that move in here that already have their education, that are ready to start their life and career, move in. As I got to looking closer at Minnesota in particular, I noticed while the 148,000 is a very positive factor, that says a lot about your state being an attractive place for smart people. I looked at the previous decade, 85 to 95. Your brain magnetism during that period was 225,000. Much more in previous years than it is now. So I got curious. I broke that 1995 to 2005 down, and you have almost lost your edge in attracting smart people. This put you as one of the most attractive states in the nation in being able to attract educated people into your state. In the last 5 years, you've fallen essentially to the national average, which is not good news for a state like Minnesota. You don't have a lot of the things that people look for when making relocation decisions. From my accent, you can tell I'm from the South. I would be reluctant to locate where I can go for a week and not see a 0-degree temperature. That's not a big factor. That's not an attractive factor for the state. Your physical climate is not great. You're not centrally located. You have a lot of things that that would show up as negatives. What you've always had that's shown up as a positive has been a great workforce, a great work ethic, and a generation after generation of the perception of investing very highly in education. That has paid off for you historically, but for some reason it seems to be diminishing in recent years, starting around 2000. Let me skip over the. In fact, some of the things that I've looked at are, some are original with me, some I'd worked with the U.S. Congressional Budget Office when they've done similar analysis. The former head of the CBO that I co-authored a study with said, I know of no valid reason that tax cuts should provide more stimulation to economic growth than does a similar amount of government spending, saying that essentially this is consistent with what the CBO has found over the years, that business and individuals tend to locate based on the whole package of taxes and spending, not simply on one side or the other. Big reason why education has been such a contributor towards growth among the states. It's very labor intensive. When you spend money on education, each one in this room has probably seen a school budget. There's not much in school spending other than labor, job creation. It's not just job creation, it's also local job creation. Education spending is very local purchase intensive. That when you spend for education, the money goes into the local community, particularly in rural Minnesota. Spending for education, unlike any other industry, stays in those rural communities. It enables people to stay in areas that they would otherwise have to leave and go somewhere else to find employment in. And again, education spending is something that relates directly to businesses' bottom line, because that's such a large that labor is such a large share of their cost, and education spending is the biggest contributor towards labor productivity. Over the longer term, your education system shows up as an amenity value to the state, just as your ability to attract brains that I've shown you on the previous chart, they come in here in large part because of your education system. Educated people like to raise their family and their kids near good education systems so that their children can do at least as well as they've done. It also improves the productivity of your workforce. The more you invest in your workforce, the more productive they are, the more money they can make for their employer. And finally, it makes your state more competitive with other states. If you show up as having a highly educated workforce and are seen as being a state that invests substantially in educational efforts at all levels, then you'll end up being more competitive in attracting business. You don't end up having to give incentives such as I was just working with Louisiana and Mississippi and those states that are trying to attract business by giving massive incentives to get businesses and firms to locate there. The reason they're having to do that, they tell you, behind closed doors, is because they're seen as being so deficient in their general workforce quality. That's something that you don't have near the issue with that a lot of southern states do. With that, let me just take any questions that might have arisen. I'd be glad to address anything that any concerns you might have or points that you'd like to raise on this.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, I don't know your name. I came in late.
Richard Sims.
And do you represent a think tank, or where do you come from?
I live in Nevada on Lake Tahoe. Previously started out working for state legislatures for about 25 years, and then worked in D.C. with the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. I've been in Lake Tahoe with my own organization for about 3 years now.
Mr. Chair, if we would take your presentation where higher public spending equals a better quality of public life, where is there a diminishing return? If we followed that logic, let's say we went to the role of Sweden and had a taxation of 50-plus percentage points, we should really have nirvana on Earth. And where does it ever have a diminishing return to the point that you tax? I suppose you can tax 100% of a salary, and that would certainly be a diminished return. Has there been any concept of how far in Western life we go before it diminishes the productivity, whether it's a government job or anything else?
Yes, there have been numerous studies, not necessarily ones that I've conducted, but ones that are in the academic literature on that. And the answer is basically it seems to be at some point slightly above where we are now. And the thing that I would emphasize on this is not to say that more spending or higher taxes causes growth. It's just that it doesn't seem to retard growth in ways that I and others would initially suspect going in. That I wouldn't say that you can, if you raise taxes and raise spending, that's the solution for growth. It just says that when we look at the evidence that states or nations that have done that, it doesn't seem to have killed their growth. That in fact they tend to have done very well. There are a lot of complex reasons on why you would grow, and my personal opinion is that these just show that that taxes don't seem to matter one way or the other, which is pretty much what most of the academic studies find, is that they're a very small factor, and that it depends on how you spend the tax money. You can spend it in ways that are seen as being wasteful and retard growth, or if you spend it on things that are seen in the marketplace as being a pretty good thing, productivity enhancing, then it can actually have a small positive effect.
Mr. Chair, you put a slide up referencing a time or a 10-year span between 1995 and 2005 showing that Minnesota is attracting smart people, or people at least that have shown that they can pass a college degree. Sometimes that isn't always the same as equal.
It doesn't necessarily correlate. You're right.
But I couldn't help but recognize that during that same time, we as a state continued to develop and increase the number of government jobs before and during and after that time period. Minnesota is one of the few states that have a very high proportion of government jobs, whether it's state, federal, or county, during that same time. One may extrapolate some different figures during that same time period. You gave us a rather finite view and an observation for that. Also during that same time, I couldn't help but notice that we have a shrinking union labor base in the state. So would we say that smarter people are not taking up union jobs? I don't think any of us politically want to make that conclusion, but I think one has to take a wider view of that decade of time to realize what else is happening in the state of Minnesota.
And that's true with all of these or anyone else's numbers they'll put up, is that they're going to be a small snapshot of a much bigger picture that's going on. That particular one just simply jumped out at me because as a percent of your current workforce, you were bringing in more bachelor's degree holders as a percent of the workers that you produce than about any other state. That made you stand out. It's why I wanted to reflect on that a little bit. And then, as I said, when I got to looking at the numbers in a little more detail for this purpose, I noticed that it was a declining factor over the decade before that. And then when I broke that down a little more discreet within, that it was declining much more even recently. And I don't pretend to know the answers on that because I haven't followed your history over the last 20 years enough to give you to know what anyone in this room would probably already know intuitively. But that did seem to be the case, that you were attracting many more college-educated people a decade before than you were now, even though you're still doing good. But then within the last 5 years, you had gone to pretty much the national average in your attraction of BS degree holders.
Anything else, members?
Mr. Chair.
Sir Langsa.
Well, I've always thought it isn't so much how much money a state spends, it's how they spend it. And I think that's sort of borne out in this. When the state of Wisconsin here about 4 years ago was wondering, the legislators were wondering why they were growing slower than Minnesota. And we're sister states that are very much alike. And they come to the conclusion that our workforce, Minnesota's workforce, was better trained and better educated. And I think that's where a lot of our money has gone in the past. Some people in my area complain about our tax rates, and I've asked them, and we're an agriculture area. I said, do the farmers and small businessmen in our area that spend the least, are they the most successful? No, it's those that spend the most, but spend it right, manage it right. So I think... Yeah, I think there is a point of diminishing returns, and I think that's where you get into some of the spending that doesn't have good payback. But when it comes to the spending that has good, very good payback, then I think Minnesota should be a state that has above-average taxes. How much above, probably, that's where you begin to reach that point of diminishing returns. But it's how you spend it more than how much you spend, I think, that determines. And I think... almost everything you said here is borne that out.
Senator, I think you're exactly correct on that. This is sort of the business approach or the Warren Buffett approach, if you will, to public investment, that you don't spend more just to spend more, that you can, within how you spend money, it matters how you spend it. There are some public spending things that don't produce anything in economic growth. There are some spending within education that is not productive. There's others that's very productive. It matters how you spend it, and diminishing returns do kick into play. You've got all these things that need to be taken into consideration. Again, with the overall knowledge that it seems like relatively high taxes if it's spent efficiently in ways that people perceive as being productive does not in itself retard growth.
Any else, members? Mr. Sims, thank you very much. That's very interesting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Mr. Chair,
sir,
would we be able to get a copy of those slides either electronically or on paper?
You certainly will. I'll make those available to you.
Thanks.
We'll to Mr. Rundquist.
And just for the committee's information, since you'll be receiving these, on each of these charts, they all came from publicly available sources so that you can check them. You can reproduce your own information. I think on all the charts I cited the public source on them, so you can look that up and see where they came from, draw your own conclusions on that.
Thank you very much.
Again, thank you very much.
Senator Sieben, do you have some people at F that need to leave?
I guess I do.
So let's try to take you first.
I'll try to go.
Then Senator Betzold is next. Senator Sieben,
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate File 1508 is the Child Protection and Safety Act, and this bill is before us today as members of the Tax Committee because child safety and child protection is a tax issue. Just to note that this bill has already passed through the Health and Human Services Policy Division, and the bill will provide stable, ongoing funding for child safety and protection. And this has come about because in the past, these activities have been funded with local, state, and a few federal dollars. And I believe you have a handout that has this pie chart that shows that child safety and protection funding has largely come from counties, more than 47%. Of child protection funding comes from the counties, but because of changes in federal funding, this bill, we're asking the state to pick up more of a percent of that funding because of cuts to mandated services. So here today to testify on behalf of this bill first is Commissioner Victoria Reinhart from Ramsey County.
Senator Sieben, I'm a little bit confused why. I mean, there's an appropriation in this bill, and this committee got a zero budget target. So I find it a little interesting that the Health and Human Service Committee would send this here. I know Senator Cohen has specifically requested that the tax bill not carry appropriations in it this year, going to the Senate floor. Can you explain to me why, if this is a good idea, Health and Human Services decided to send it here?
I'll do my best, Mr. Chair. As a result of the federal cuts, more than $55 million Minnesota will receive, these costs are going to be pushed on to the county budgets, and therefore I think the argument can be made that because we have to perform these services, that the costs will be picked up in increased property taxes. That's the best explanation I can give you.
Senator Sieben, you were in the Health and Human Service Committee. Didn't the governor put $40 million in that committee of one-time money to help buy down some of these federal cuts?
Mr. Chair, that is my understanding. Perhaps the testifiers can help explain why. Your question more.
Good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Victoria Reinhart. I'm on the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners, and this morning I'm here to testify on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties, MACSA, and MICA on a very critical issue to counties, and it really is about property taxes as far as the purview of this committee. I, just like you as an elected official, know that our constituents expect certain basic services from government. Of course, they expect us to make wise financial decisions. As Senator Langseth talked about, it's how you spend the money. They also expect decent roads, safe neighborhoods, basic health, public health protections, and they do expect that children will be safe from neglect and abuse and have permanent, stable homes. In recent years, we've really made a lot of progress in this area, and we've reduced our out-of-home placement costs, which is a cost that is borne entirely by county government. Because we have become smarter in ways of keeping families together and or finding permanent homes for them. We've had this success in part because we put a lot of county money, a lot of federal money, and a little bit of state money into this.
Good.
Recent federal and state budget reductions threaten to turn this around. In January of 2006, the Federal Deficit Reduction Act changed the rules and disallowed about $90 million in annual Medicaid funds for targeted case management. And of that amount, $55 million of this was for child safety and protection services performed by counties. One of the things, as I was out at the federal government and talking to them and also here, was a question about, isn't this just frosting on the cake? And my response to that was, it's not only not frosting on the cake, it's not even the cake. It's meat and potatoes. It's about basic survival and basic child protection services for kids in Minnesota. Counties had to account for this loss in preparing for their calendar year 07 budgets. Counties like Ramsey County, and this is where the property tax part of this comes in, we cut $1.8 million out of our services, and we had about a $2.5 million projected deficit, and we looked at one-time funds for that. But we realized that if we put one-time funds out of our reserves, that it was simply going to make the problem worse in following years, and we needed to do something that was going to be a more stable, ongoing funding source. So even though we had major reductions in the amount of money that was spent, we still increased in Ramsey County our property taxes by 1.2% as a direct result of these reductions. When AMC surveyed counties last year on how much money they expected to lose in child protection services as a result of the reductions, for selected counties, the relation to federal dollars to their 2000 and property tax levies showed that in order to recover, the amount of money that they would have to put into property taxes was quite substantial. In Ramsey County alone, again, if we had taken care of or replaced all of the funds in targeted case management or for this purpose, it would have been 2.85% for this one item alone in increased spending. In order to continue to do this, to do just the minimum required by law, we are drawing from other parts of our health and human services, such as long-term care, public health, and mental health, in order to cover these costs. We are drawing down dollars that could be used for more prevention and early intervention services. And since the property values across the state vary, the result will be disparities in property tax capacity. I would say that this is one of the single biggest cost drivers facing counties today, and that the shortfalls in funds for child safety and protection is over twice the amount of county program aid, which was short by $25 million over to 2003 levels just in this one area. This is, as I said, I mean, we care, obviously, everyone, I think, cares about keeping children safe in their homes. But in the end, these are mandated services, and we do need to keep children safe. And the fact is, without permanent, stable, ongoing funding from the state, one-time funds are good to get us through, to get us a bridge. But ultimately, we need to have long-term funding for this. Otherwise, our children are going to be in trouble. We're going to have probably go back to more out-of-home placement, and in the end, it's the counties and property taxes that are going to end up paying for this.
Mr. Chair, Judith Brumfield, who is the Assistant Director of Community Services from Scott County, has some comments too.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Judith Rumfield, and I'm the Assistant Community Services Director in Scott County, and I'm here today representing AMC, the Minnesota Association of Social Service Directors, the MICA organization, and the MSSA. Let me just very briefly give you the background of the bill or an overview of the bill. First of all, this establishes a child safety fund that is meant to be permanent ongoing funding for the child protection system in Minnesota. It also is a bill that holds counties accountable. There are performance standards within this bill, and if the bill is funded, if the fund is set aside for child protection services, counties will be held accountable to certain performance standards and will need to make reports every 2 years. The Department of Human Services will make those reports public every 2 years about how counties are doing, and ongoing funding will be contingent upon meeting performance targets. The formula within the bill starts out as a historical formula because we are talking about the loss of federal funds. But over 5 years, it will move toward a formula based on need. Again, we're trying to look at the county's capacity to tax, and that knowing that varies across the state, that a fair formula, a formula that is fair to children, ought to be based on the needs of the county, the tax potential of the county, as opposed to simply historical earnings. Finally, within this bill, there's the opportunity for tribes to participate at whatever level they choose to through negotiation with the state. The important parts of this bill is that it's ongoing, stable funding. We do know, and there was mention of the $40 million in the governor's budget, that would be one-time funding. Like the state, counties have to balance their budget, and they need to predict ahead of time what kind of finances they will have coming in. So one-time funding really doesn't solve the problems. The counties are still raising property tax levy because year to year they don't know whether money is available. The system that is built has to be stable over time. What has happened in Minnesota is a little over 10 years ago, early to mid-90s, the state was in a recession. As a result of that, as federal funds became available under medical assistance, the counties made the federal match to medical assistance, which is 50%. The state couldn't afford to do that. Since that time, the state has not only not invested in child welfare services, but as a result of some of the 2003 cuts, counties have actually lost about $200 million in human service funding. Now, as the federal government is pulling back on its management funding, and we expect that this can also be retroactive, so we could lose all of our 2006 funding, as well as into the future. Counties not only have to pay the 50%, but now will need to make up the additional 50%, which is about $55 million for child protection services alone. We're aware the legislature is considering a number of proposals for new spending, and we would emphasize that this is a core service. It's a critical service for our children, and we would encourage you to think first of these core services before expanding new spending. We believe that all children in Minnesota deserve to be safe, to have the same level of child protection services without regard to where they live, and for the services to be different across the state based upon the taxing capacity of any particular county, simply not acceptable in terms of our children. Referring back very briefly to the presentation you heard just before this bill was heard, talking about the need to have educated workforce, let me stress that children who are not safe in their homes are not able to learn. They don't do well in school. They drop out of high school, become active in the criminal justice system. An investment in child protection is a very necessary precursor to any investment in a long-term workforce in Minnesota. So we see a direct tie to the future economic stability of our state by investing in the protection of children at this point in time. Thank you.
Senator Sieben, what other committees was this bill heard in?
Senator Marty's committee, Health Policy Committee.
Members, the bill was heard in Health Policy, sent to Full Finance, and Full Finance, rather than sending it to the Health and Human Service Division, made a decision for some reason to send it here. Now, clearly this should be heard in the Health and Human Services Finance Division. I mean, that's where the appropriation would come from. I don't know exactly what happened. Senator Cohen didn't talk to me about the idea that it would come here rather than to Senator Berglund's committee. So
Sirmois?
Mr. Chair, I agree with you that perhaps that's the path. But while it's here, though, I must say that it is quite compelling to have this issue in this committee because it really does highlight the impact that county services has on property taxes. And regardless of where it ends up and how it gets funded, I think that it's been good to have at least a subject discussed in this committee in terms of the kind of unfunded mandates that goes to the counties. And when the counties don't have any other resources to pay for anything, they go directly to the property taxes to do that. And so regardless of where it ends up being funded, it has made a point for me in having it in this committee.
Sirmois, my concern is clean water in Senator Anderson's committee. I mean, our communities are going to have to do something to develop TMDLs to clean up polluted water. And Senator Anderson's committee might decide to send us the appropriation for that because cities faced with making improvements to their wastewater treatment system will have to go to the property taxpayer to get it paid. So we're headed down kind of a slippery slope here if we start allowing finance committees to send their appropriation bills to the tax committee. Because I think if we bring a tax bill to the floor that has all kinds of appropriations in it, I don't think we want to start going down that road. Senator Dibble?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure exactly what we would do with this bill. I mean, it's nice to have the debate, and I think it's important. Actually, I would like to, you know, ask the executive branch maybe to prepare a report for us to find out exactly what all of the implications of the Federal Deficit Reduction Act of last year are for our local property taxes and our state budget. I don't think we really have a full grasp. I mean, there's the targeted case management issue. There's all kinds of stuff that's being handed off to the states as a result of that bill that was passed early last year. A lot of that stuff still has yet to be implemented, and we're just kind of waiting for those shoes to drop. I agree with you that this probably needs to go back to the Health Committee, if for no other reason than to match it up with some significant policy that's traveling in a bill that I moved in that committee that has to do with runaway homeless youth, which calls for some coordination with the child welfare provisions we have in statute so that we're serving youth better from a prevention perspective, recognizing that this system doesn't necessarily get to a lot of the youth that we need to. But I don't know what we do with this bill at this point other than talk about property taxes.
Sir Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sarah Sieben, did I understand that this was a governor's-inspired bill, or is it not?
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, the governor had a one-time appropriation for $40 million to make up for some of the cuts as a result of the Federal Deficit Reduction Act. So, and to sort of address what Senator Bach said, I understand your frustration. I understand your concern about this is headed down a slippery slope. Perhaps this, I would hope that we could refer this back to the Finance Division and at least for members of this committee, we're more aware of how different this policy implication and the effect it could have on property taxes. And again, like the testifiers mentioned, this is a one-time appropriation in the governor's budget, but the services that are going to be that we need to pay for under this bill are definitely going to be an ongoing cost for counties.
Senator Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben. Yes, I think you have a good initiative here. When the property tax division was putting their bill together, we were working to find dollars for counties for property tax relief, and we were under the impression that this was being carried in the Health and Human Services budget division. So I am surprised to see it here. I would think that we would need, as the chair and other members have said, that we would need to send this back to the finance division for them to work through. But we certainly weren't thinking that this was in our obligations at that time. And so I would hope that we're able to send this back to finance.
Sure. Senator Scoy moves that Senate File 1508 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last witness made a comment, and I wanted to, maybe that would open our minds up to considering whether it's in our jurisdiction or not. Did you make mention that this is a formula would be created based on need per county? Is that correct? Is that what this
means? Mr. Chair, Senator Lemmer, exactly. The formula would start out based on historical earnings, 90%, and 10% on need, and through the next 5 years. So by year five, it would be based on need. The need formula is the number of children who are at or below the poverty level.
And, Mr. Chair, does it also create a means test so that those counties that have a high property wealth will get essentially less state aid to conduct this for in relationship to the number or the need that's in that county?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lemmer, the Department of Human Services actually helped to work the formula out, and their information would show that the number of children in poverty relate directly to the taxing capacity of counties, so that by tying the need to the number of children in poverty, you are actually looking at the taxing capacity of the county. So the counties that have higher taxing capacity will receive less money. And it's a formula that is refigured on an ongoing basis. So as counties grow or diminish in their taxing capacity, their funding would vary based on that.
So, Mr. Chair, then I can see where some counties may come out very well from the state allocation of funds, and other counties may not. And they'll have to go to their individual taxpayers and seek that additional funds to compensate for what they don't get or what other counties don't get. That may be the reason why it was sent here, for us to understand that. But I think it would be helpful for us to have maybe a computer run of which county gets the best benefit and what doesn't. It could have some unintended consequences. It certainly could reduce property taxes in some county, but it may cause an increase in others. And I think I at least would want to know.
Well, Senator Lemmer, it's a blank appropriation, so it would be a pretty odd-looking run.
Yeah, it would be.
It would have a lot of zeros on it.
Well, then we have a difficulty making a decision, don't we?
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, for all those reasons, I would request that you change your motion to make it a without recommendation motion, that we pass it along, because we have not studied the issue, and I don't think that this committee should be making a recommendation, but it would be better if we just passed it without a recommendation, and I would appreciate that very much.
Senator Skoy?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would make that change in the motion to pass this without recommendation.
Got it, members?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Sandra.
I'm looking at page 5 of the bill, and I suppose I'm trying to understand it to a degree. And the bill seems to be about child safety and neglect and abuse. And then on page 5 of the bill, there's a lot of percentages that seem to relate to poverty indexes, so to speak. Is the premise of the bill that things like abuse, neglect, are directly correlated to poverty? Is that why we kind of fund it as we're proposing to fund it here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum, no, abuse and neglect is not necessarily related to poverty. The issue here is that at this point in time, counties are paying about 48% of the cost of child protection. Losing the federal money, what the counties are asking through this task force that was formed by the Department of Human Services is that the state pick up a larger share. But the idea is that in order for children to be treated fairly throughout the state, counties need the same capacity to provide these services. So counties that have a larger number of poorer children have also a larger number of families of low income. Therefore, their tax base, their property tax base, tends to be lower. So that by doing a formula based on the income level of families, you are therefore equalizing the amount of money per child available throughout Minnesota, so that the amount that the county that has a very low tax base and cannot increase their property taxes to the same extent as a county with a better tax base would have the same per capita amount to spend on children. So what we do then is to allow children to be treated with the same degree of funding no matter where they live in Minnesota.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Chair?
Let's go ahead.
Mr. Chair, from what I can tell, this is completely outside of the current county program aid formula, so this would be an addition to whatever county program aid we're doing.
Anything else, members? On the SCOI motion to re-refer Senate File 1508 without recommendation to finance. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate File 892 is a bill that we looked at a week ago, and this is regarding authorizing local governments and school districts to establish trust to pay for post-employment benefits to retired employees. The issue that we had last week that caused you to lay it over and think about it for a few more days, Senator Pogemiller raised two questions. One, on page one, towards the bottom of the page, it allows the trust money to be established with either the Public Employees Retirement Association or, and the issue that was raised was banks or banking associations or an insurance company or an agency qualified to do business in Minnesota. That was one issue. The second issue was whether or not there should be allowed of a revocable trust, which you can see on page three starting on line nine. I believe in the past week you've had an opportunity to meet with some of the stakeholders who've been going around talking about this issue. I'm not sure if there's any other issues or concerns that this committee has at this point on this bill, Mr. Chair.
Well,
members, there is an A2 amendment that I don't think we need to pass at all. We can just have some discussion about deleting the irrevocable part out of the bill and make the bill just. Or, no, excuse me, deleting the revocable part.
Revocable, yeah.
And making the bill just an irrevocable account. Anybody have interest in that? Senator Scoy?
Well, Mr. Chair, I've had some discussion about this, and maybe Mr. Carlson would want to come up and help us, but one of the things that happens is with the irrevocable provision, if the jurisdiction is contributing to that and there are major changes to law that deal with the pensions or health insurance or their costs, that they are have then committed themselves and they are not able to make adjustments that, you know, changes outside of their jurisdiction have made. And so I think maybe Mr. Carlson could give us some information there that would be helpful in us making a decision with regard to the revocable provision here.
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Inter County Association. Mr. Chairman, members, I guess the first issue that I want to clarify in the minds of the committee is that the creation or funding of these revocable trusts does not create a carte blanche authority for the affected local governments to do anything that they want with these monies. What it does permit them to do is, to the extent that circumstances in the future result in an overfunding of these accounts above and beyond their actuarial liability for retiree health care or post-employment benefits, the excess of those monies and only the excess of those monies can be withdrawn and used for other governmental purposes. That could include funding other programs or reducing the local government's levy in the future. The reason why local governments would be looking for this flexibility is one, as was discussed at the last meeting, many of the local governments in the state's only obligation for retiree health care and its only liability under the new housing standard, GASB 45, is as a result of the state law that says we must permit retirees to participate in our group health insurance or health benefits programs. And the standard says, to the extent that the members of that insurance plan pay higher premiums because of the retiree's prior participation, we have a liability that we must account for on our accounting statements. The bond rating agencies, creditors, taxpayers who look at our financial statements aren't going to know that the reason why that liability exists, and as a result, we're going to want to put aside money to be able to tell them in a clear-cut manner by just looking at our financial statements that we're setting aside monies to take care of these liabilities in the future. But again, if circumstances change, if state law, federal law is changed, if our underlying health plans change, which will change our liability, we want the alternative or the flexibility of being able to pay out, pull out the excess funding if that eventuality
you still have to use it.
The alternative of putting the monies in the irrevocable trust are such that the money has to stay there until the last beneficiary dies. So we're basically setting aside the money, and we can't touch it for at least 20 to 30 years based on the potential current obligations that we have, whereas this gives us the flexibility to both earn a higher return for the monies that are being set aside for these purposes and to get at monies again if circumstances should change in the future and we find ourselves in an overfunded situation. Mr. Chairman, I think that's a short explanation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Carlson, you currently can put money into short-term investments, which, as you mentioned, is at a lower interest rate. Could you talk a little bit about the interest rate differential and then the risk and how you're going to manage that with regard to this proposed revocable trust? Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members, in general, this legislation of Senator Betzold's provides two things. One, the ability to create either revocable or irrevocable trust, and once monies have been placed inside those trusts, two, to invest them in the same set of investment vehicles as is available to local governments for funding pension obligations currently. Because this retiree health care are of the same long-term nature, those investment options include higher-rated bonds, include equities, and over the long term, the historic higher rate of return on those investment vehicles will allow us to more appropriately meet these longer-term obligations. There's the committee should be aware that there is risk involved in this, but since we're setting aside the money for obligations that won't be due until 20 or 30 years from now, we are going to have to manage those risks by the year-to-year fluctuations, by appropriate diversification in the portfolio, the same as is done for pension obligations right now. We will have to disclose the rate of return that we get from those investments in our annual financial statements, as well as any costs that we pay to the investment advisors, as well as the trust administrators. So all that information will be disclosed, and it will be readily apparent to our creditors, our taxpayers, if we're managing these dollars appropriately.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Carlson, I'm a political subdivision or public entity can make these choices to invest or to withdraw the funds. Is it safe to assume that they are going to be having public hearings about these things because they'll have to be making decisions as a public municipality or as an entity or as a subdivision, so that they would have to involve the public in making those decisions before they make them?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, yes, in short. Any dollars that the local government unit actually sets aside to meet these obligations will have to be debated as part of the city, county, or school district's budget. And so in the normal budget deliberations that occur, plus the truth in taxation, to the extent we're talking about the counties, the larger cities, and the school districts, will be part of the deliberation that the public will be able to participate in. So the actual policy of setting aside the money or expending the money will be subject to those normal processes.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Carlson, you and I discussed this yesterday a little bit as it relates to absolutely guaranteeing in the revocable trust that if, in fact, the liability is always available and set aside, and that only amounts over that could be used for other purposes. As I read the language in Subdivision 7, can you provide me some comfort that this accomplishes that with the unless language? I'm just a little uncomfortable with that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Larson, starting at the top of Subdivision 7, the first sentence gives the ability to withdraw the money. And I have suggested to council that the language on line 3.11 for any reason is really superfluous and could be deleted, because the language then goes on. Once the money has been withdrawn, it is put into a separate, segregated or distinct fund in the public entity, and then only if the conditions that are identified the language starting on lines 3.31 through 3.23 come into play, that there's a change in state and federal law, that there's a change in the demographics of the employees eligible to participate, that there's a change in the entity's health plan or some other factor that will change the actuarial liability. If any of those factors result in the plan being overfunded in excess of on line 3.23 going on to 3.24 of 100% of the entity's actuarially determined liability for the post-employment benefit, then the excess may be withdrawn and used for any purpose. It's only the excess above and beyond their actuarial liability that may be withdrawn and ultimately used for other purposes.
Senator Larson moves on line 3.11. After the word account, delete for any reason. Senator Larson, that sound okay?
That sounds right, Mr. Chair. So moved.
Members? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary, no. Aye. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Members have anything else? Senator Bethel, would you like to carry this in the tax bill and the public finance article, or?
The finance committee may need to see this bill. I'm not sure. If you look at the title, it says appropriating money. We're not. There is no appropriation in this bill, but that's in the title. It does have some language. If you look on page line 4.3 to 4.4, it says the legislature may not divert funds in these trusts for use for other purpose. I don't know if that's a finance issue. The next subdivision 8 talks about how all money are not subject to claims by creditors of the state and so forth. I have not been notified by the Finance Committee that they need to see this bill. I serve on that committee. It could raise issues, but definitely we got to strike. At least if this bill were, if this bill were to be rolled into another bill, we would not care about the title. But so It doesn't matter to me, Mr. Chair, but perhaps if you want to keep it here, I can do so. We can flag it to the Finance Committee, ask them if they want to see it, and if they want it, we'll just notify your office to move it out.
Well, we're not appropriating any money in this bill.
I know, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Senator Scoy moves on line 1.14 in the title. After the word officers, delete appropriating money, semicolon. Senator Betzel, does that make sense?
Yes, it does, yeah.
Oh, I don't,
apparently,
I don't.
The if you look at 2.11, it says the amount of any fees charged by a PERA is appropriated to the association from the account. That may raise a finance issue. And it does it use the word appropriation, but it's not a direct appropriation.
Mr. Chair.
Mr.
Chair, Senator Betzel, isn't that just a reference to the appropriation to the from the account back to the municipality? It's an internal appropriation. It's not a reference to general fund appropriation.
Just allowing them to keep the fees.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Mary Vanek. I'm the director of PERA. Senator DeMoy, you're correct. We don't receive any general funded appropriations for our administration, so it's just taking money from the account and paying it to PERA for fees for the services we provide in the trust administration.
It should just stay here.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, it should just stay here.
Bill should.
Yeah.
On the SCOI motion, line 1.14, to delete appropriating money? 1.4. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Senator Betzel, why don't we just leave it here for now? We will put it in the public finance article. We'll check with finance and see if there's some reason they need to see it. I don't know what the House Companion is doing. It might be safer in the tax bill than...
I'm not sure, Mr. Chair. But when you get questions on the floor on this article, just look to me and I'll do the best I can.
You won't be the only one that'll be having questions referred to them on the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Moy moves that Senate File 892, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the public finance article. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Senator Rest here. Senator Rest, which bill would you like to start with?
We'll start with the Taxpayer Assistance Grants Bill.
Senate File 1669, members. Senator Rest, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 1669 is a proposal to increase the dollars that are currently going into the Department of Revenue, specifically dedicated to taxpayer assistance programs. This appropriation, which I've heard you speak about, the tax bill doesn't have appropriations. This is one that has been carried routinely in the tax bill and started in 1999, progressing through the years to increasing it in 2006-2007 to a total of $250,000. And then the most important thing is that at that point it became part of the department's base. The fiscal note is a little bit strange in that it does not reflect the base amount that's there with this additional $75,000 that's being requested for each year. There also was some concern in this last fiscal or in this last grant application cycle about the timeliness of the application process and the awarding of the grants, and there is an amendment that I would appreciate the committee considering that requests the department to give notice of the grant process and also to award the grants by October 1st so that the grantees will have ample time to plan their own budgets, volunteer programs, et cetera. There's one change that I would like to make on it, and that is where it says, and I think about the last line of the amendment, where it says that the commissioner must also notify nonprofit organizations that received grants. If you would strike received and insert applied for, so that anyone in the previous cycle that had applied for a grant, regardless of whether they had received it or not, would get a special letter as well as being able to access the public notice. And then there's an October 1 date there for awarding the grants.
Senator Skoy moves the A1 amendment and incorporates on line 1.1, delete the word received and insert applied for.
Mr. Chairman and members, you have a packet of information about the kinds of organizations that participate in the volunteer tax assistance, taxpayer assistance programs, and also the green sheet that shows in Greater Minnesota the number of clients that are served by the taxpayer assistance programs. When we started, most of the help was being given, quite frankly, in the metropolitan area by the group that is now called Accountability Minnesota, and then it used to be the Minnesota Accounting Aid Society. They changed it to Accountability Minnesota about 5 years ago. I, quite frankly, was one of their volunteers when I was practicing as a CPA and doing volunteer taxpayer assistance work in one of their sites, and actually opened a site in my own community and managed that until I was in the legislature. And then I had to miss too many sessions because of the timing of the scheduling at the Capitol. I do have some folks here to testify briefly on why the increase is being requested.
Does the department have a comment on the A1 amendment? Can we get this done by October 1st?
Mr. Chairman, I did speak with them prior to the meeting, and they were very comfortable with the amendment. And it was at their suggestion that we change the language from received to applied for.
On the SCOI motion on the A1 amendment as orally amended on line 1.10. Favor signify by saying aye.
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 Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Bill is amended. Senator Rest, your testifiers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nan Madden. I am the Minnesota Budget Project Director at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. The Minnesota Budget Project provides research, analysis, and advocacy on budget and tax issues, and we particularly take a look at the impact of fiscal decisions on low-income Minnesotans. And I'm also a past volunteer with a volunteer tax assistance site. We have long supported the taxpayer assistance grants. We feel it is a very important investment in implementing a fair tax system And I think we've seen through the recent discussions of the new tax incident study the very large role that our tax credits play in maintaining a fair tax system. The taxpayer assistance grants has enjoyed broad bipartisan support from the legislature over the years and has had strong support from the Department of Revenue as well. We think that the taxpayer assistance grants are a real win-win situation. For the Department of Revenue, they see that people's tax returns are filled out correctly. The returns are largely e-filed, which may not be done otherwise. And taxpayers who may be new to the income tax system or intimidated by the complexity of the system are served in the community by organizations and at locations they trust. So we strongly urge your support for Senate File 1669.
My name is Bonnie Esposito. I'm the Executive Director of Accountability Minnesota. Thank you for this opportunity to support this bill. Our organization has received these grants over the years, and to give you a sense of our work, in the packet you've received, you have a handout that talks about our accomplishments. And you can see with increased funding over the years, we have really been able to increase how many people that we serve. Last year, we had about 30 tax sites around the state, and were able to help over 10,000 people, almost 11,000 people, receive $13.7 million in tax refunds. The earned income tax credit is really an incredible boost to local economies. Last year, Minnesotans, low-income Minnesotans, received over $400 million. But the IRS suggests, or actually their estimate is that between 10 and 20% of people that are eligible for the EITC don't claim it. And it's for a variety of reasons. But one reason these grants are so important is that they fund small organizations, community-based organizations, that touch the lives of these people that otherwise wouldn't file a return. So, for instance, these grants, many of our community partners receive small grants, and even a small amount of money, $3,000, $4,000, can make a big difference. It could hire perhaps an interpreter or a local Latino person to do outreach within the community. It can help buy laptops so people can do electronic filing. Many sites would not be able to open their doors without this grant to help them recruit volunteers and so forth. These grants are really an investment in not only helping bring federal dollars into the state, but also building capacity in our communities. There's one piece I want to draw your attention to that's in the packet. It's called An Investment Letter from Minnesota Philanthropists, and it was put together by Peter Hegard with the 1% Club. And his research is much like the research done by Art Rolnick with the early childhood education issue. And what he found is by looking at Accountability Minnesota, how much our budget is and how much money we're able to help return to the state, that we have a return on investment of 145%. We're just one of many nonprofits that have enjoyed this grant, have been able to receive modest grants, but it really has helped us grow. So thank you for considering the grant, and I really urge you to approve the increase in funding.
Anything else, members? Good program, Senator Rest.
It's a great program. It's just amazing to me the dollars that come back that are under this program, because people generally who are eligible for the EITC, which is a lot of what is done, the Working Family Credit, the Minnesota Working Family Credit, that go to these centers and they get their rent credits done or the M1PR filled out for them, are what they do is spend those refunds in their own communities. These are refunds that stimulate the economy because they're spent on groceries, they're spent on the neighborhood clothing store, and they are and they're getting dollars that are due to taxpayers. These are not handouts. These are refunds, state refunds and federal refunds that are actually due to these taxpayers that are otherwise go unclaimed. And it would be hoped for that with some additional funding that we can leverage even more, because there will be more availability to increase the number of participants. So I do hope the tax committee will consider it.
Without objection, the chair lays over Senate File 1669 as amended for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ress, Senate File 696.
Mr. Chairman and members, I do have a couple of handouts if you could get your page here. The two handouts are letters of endorsement from AARP Minnesota and the Alzheimer's Association for Senate File 696, and this is a program that would set up a tax credit for home caregivers that is at the level that otherwise families would be paying for personal care attendance. Many Minnesota families devote a lot of their time and effort and care and love in taking care of elderly parents or chronically disabled young adults or children. That really does create a financial hardship on the family, but they are saving a lot of the taxpayers' dollars with regard to those folks not going into long-term care facilities and avoiding that as long as possible for those families. And what the bill does is to recognize the gift of these family caregivers, not only to the family member that they're caring for, but also to the rest of us. We know that the demographics are changing with regard to the number of people that are going to need care, and I believe that it is important that, insofar as we are able, that we encourage families to see to that care in their own home if they are able. There was a short article in the newspaper today talking about the I think it was a 10% increase in the number of people over 65 who are suffering from or will suffer from Alzheimer's, and that is going to be an increasing number of folks in our population, not all of whom are going to be, or probably many of whom families are going to want to care for them in those folks in their homes. So what the bill does is to set up a process of certification for the need so that the person receiving the care meets a certain standard, and then sets up what the level of care needs to be in order to qualify for the credit, and then sets up a refundable credit. If you look at the revenue estimate, this is quite an expensive proposition. I have had a conversation with the chair about some suggestions if the committee wants to take on this proposal of ways to make it less costly. Of course, one of the first things to look at is make the credit itself less, and that brings down the cost. There also has a suggestion from the community that's been working on this bill to not make the not to have to use the long-term care consultation team approach, but simply have a kind of like a note from your doctor so that most of these folks are going to have at least an annual visit with a physician who could certify that they are in need of the type of care that rises to the level of the PCA, and so there would be far less bureaucracy, far less involvement of the county long-term care consultation teams. A third way of still promoting the proposal with and reducing the cost is to make it a non-refundable credit rather than a refundable credit. So those are some of the suggestions. I would offer one or two or three of them as you look at this bill if you would consider possibly beginning it in the tax committee. And now I'd like to turn to my testifier here. We do have members from the AARP here who are supporting it. They would stand ready for questions, but this is my only testifier.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joel Euland. I'm from the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, Minnesota chapter. I also am the co-chair of the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, a coalition of about 100 disability organizations in Minnesota. I'm here along with AARP and the Alzheimer's Association in support of Senate File 696. This bill provides a recognition for caregivers that we feel is really essential to recognize the work that is going on out in the community. It provides, as was mentioned before, up to $2,400 per year in a tax credit for these people. I think for something to consider in this is that for a primary caregiver, this comes as at a real price for them and for their families. It comes in the price of there's lost wages. A lot of times the caregivers also having to pass up promotions at work because of what they are doing at home. It has been estimated by the National Multiple Sclerosis Society that just in the area of MS, that it costs a household in which somebody is diagnosed with MS, it costs that household almost $50,000 per year in the form of lost wages, out-of-pocket expenses, the home modifications that need to be made in the home, and so on, just related to having multiple sclerosis. So while a $2,400 tax credit certainly doesn't solve all the problems, it does recognize what is going on in that home to help person stay independent, stay out of a nursing home placement. I think when you look at the price that is listed in the kind of the fiscal estimate here, one of the things that I'd also point out is what's not reflected is the medical assistance costs that are not being not happening because that person is being able to stay out of a nursing home or isn't requiring as much community-based services. So that would kind of sum up my testimony. I'd stand for any questions.
Anything, members? Senator Squay.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest, you did mention a little bit if this is somewhat scalable. Do you have any feel for what some of these changes might do with regard to the total cost, or is that something that we're going to have to look at further?
I think that's something that, Mr. Chairman and Senator Squay, that that the committee would need to consider relative with the Department of Revenue, and I certainly would be happy to talk with them. I mean, even if you cut just scalable one for one, if you cut the tax credit itself to one-fourth, $600 a year, I mean, that's down to under $10 million to start with. I'm not sure of the impact of the refundable credit versus non-refundable, because I don't know how many people in that universe would be then not included. And it is means tested, so it's not for everyone.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, with regard to the refundable credit, I looked at that, but I'm hesitant to to use that, because really the folks that are the lowest income and probably the no income need the help the most.
Mr. Chairman, and that certainly was the rationale for including it, first of all, as a refundable credit. But I think for me, getting the principal in place to start with, it would be the most important thing. But that would be the part, I guess, that I would give up last. The thing that is most concerning to me that I think could be taken care of easily, no matter where we, no matter what happened with the tax credit part of it, is not making a complicated system of actually certifying that someone was eligible and that the caregiver was actually giving that kind of care. And I thought that the suggestion of not using the long-term care consultation team, but relying on an affidavit from a physician was an excellent suggestion to not put an additional burden on the long-term care consultation teams that counties have.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, to the point of the application, I think you're right. You don't want this to be complicated, but if we make the application process easier, it kind of works against the, because that would increase the utilization, I would imagine, which would bring the cost up.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Scoy, that would be true, but the on the other hand, the department, I think the estimate for it is the universe of people that would be eligible to start with rather than whether they applied for it or not.
Okay, yeah, so. That's thank you.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, I think it's a very good proposal. It's also very expensive, like you said. And I was thinking about a couple of ways that you might be able to reduce the cost here. One would be, I'm looking at line 2.23. The credit allowed is only one credit may be claimed for each service recipient in any tax year. I'm wondering if you reduce that to one credit per household, so that if you were caring for, say, two aging parents or two disabled adults or someone, then mm-hmm. it was one credit per household, might make a difference in terms of the overall expense. And then the second thing I was thinking was the implementation plan could be phased in much slower. You've got 80, 90, and 100% in 3 years, and you could do a 50, 75, 100 or something like that. You could mm-hmm. slow down the phase in. But I agree with Senator Scoy that I would hate to see you give up the refundable part of it. Part here, because the people that need it the most then would be taken out. Incentivize those folks to care for these folks in their homes.
Senator Ortman, I've asked fiscal to try and cook up a couple different proposals for us that can lower the cost of this. Senator Rest, I really would like to put something in the bill.
I appreciate that very much, Senator Bott, Mr. Chairman.
People that carry out this care for their family members are very admirable people, taking care of very vulnerable people in the state in the way I think we all want them to be taken care of, if it's possible. And if we can provide a little financial incentive that helps them, I think that's very good work that we're doing.
Well, Mr. Chairman, too, I think that it's not that people are going to stop doing this if they don't get this credit, but it is a recognition from the rest of us of appreciation for not only their acts of love toward their family members, but they also are, they're saving all the rest of us taxpayers the cost of caring for their family members in nursing homes when any number of these people or other long-term care facilities, any number of these people would be more than eligible to receive that and the taxpayers would be the ones who would be funding it.
Anything else, members? Senator Rest, we're going to try to find a way we can fit
appreciate
something in here
much.
Into our target.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members.
Chair moves to lay Senate
File 696 over for possible inclusion without objection. Senator Larson.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Larson has Senate file 1776 in front of the committee.
Mr. Chair, I have an A1 amendment, which is an author's amendment that is actually, I had introduced these as two bills, but it's very related and would make sense, I think, for us to have a discussion at the same time if the committee would be so willing.
Senator Larson moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like to have it. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. A1 amendment's adopted. Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate file 1776, as amended, does two things. First, it seeks to exempt from state income tax the federal food program funds received by providers to deliver nutritious meals to children in their care. And secondly, by allowing family child care providers the same access to the Minnesota Child and Dependent Care Credit given to all other families whose income is eligible. Mr. Chair, in a moment, I'll be asking Mr. Tom Copeland, director of the Red Leaf National Institute, who is a leading expert on the business of child care and child care tax issues, to testify. But first I'd like to say that regardless of the ever-increasing demand, the supply of high-quality family child care is directly affected by the costs imposed on those who provide it. Child care reimbursements to providers rarely cover the actual costs of delivering care. The amount that private pay parents can afford to pay leaves most providers who work more than 50 hours a week earning less than the minimum wage. After paying for food, activities, training, and other expenses, a typical family child care provider has net earnings that average less than $10,000. Like many small business owners, the family child care providers rarely have access to affordable health care, paid sick days, or other basic benefits that help people stay in a career. These pressures, cause many providers to leave the profession every year. I was approached earlier this year by providers and their union with ideas to support the business of family child care in ways that do not pass additional costs on to parents. This bill accomplishes that. Mr. Chair, at this time I'd like to have Mr. Copeland, again from the Red Leaf National Institute, testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator. I've worked in the nonprofit field for about 25 years. I help family child care providers.
Mr. Copeland, can we get your name and who you represent for the record?
I apologize. Tom Copeland. I'm director of Red Leaf National Institute out of St. Paul. I help family child care providers manage their business by providing education services in the area of taxes, record keeping, contracts, marketing. People go into the child care field. Don't go into it because they enjoy record keeping. They do this because they love children. They want to support their families. Family child care providers, what we're talking about are those people who are licensed by the state to care for children out of their home. We're not talking about child care centers, commercial facilities that you'll see from the road. About 90 plus percent of these people are female. They're usually caring for about 2 to 10 children. They usually have preschool children of their own. That's often a reason why they're providing this service. Majority have college educations. Majority have previous work experiences outside of the home. As is mentioned, there's lots of turnover. The average provider probably stays in this field 3 to 5 years. And there's approximately 12,000 licensed providers in the state currently. The bill that we're proposing here is looks at the federal food program. It's a program out of the Department of Agriculture that provides nutritious meals to family child care providers. When they serve these nutritious meals, they get reimbursed at a set rate by the federal government. This food program comes out of the same area of the Department of Agriculture that also deals with the school lunch program, food stamps. Providers, all licensed providers are eligible to participate on this program. If they are low income or serve low income children or live in a low income area, they get a higher rate. In order to get that higher rate for income eligibility, if they're a family of two, they'd have to be making less than $24,000. So it's a low income program for those folks. People are receiving the higher rate. They're getting about $900 a year from this program. People who are not getting the higher rate or getting the lower rate are getting about $450 a year per child. This bill would eliminate the state income tax on this federal money that's coming into the state. It will help reduce some of the financial burden on these family child care providers as they enter this field. Unlike food stamps and the school lunch program, money received through the food program is taxable income, taxable for federal purposes as well as state. By passing this bill, I think it will help reduce turnover, thus giving parents some more choice. It will increase incentives for providers to become licensed, which I think therefore helps increase the quality of care. The estimates that were done, I just saw them this morning about the revenue estimates here, I think, in looking at this quickly, I think are probably high because providers who are caring for their own children and are low income themselves qualify for getting reimbursements for their own children. And if that's the case, the money they get for their own children under this program is not taxed on the federal level or the state level. So that's not accounted for in here, so I think these numbers are a little high. Also, the estimate of a 3% growth rate each year, I think, is probably a little high. I know this for this year, the rate went up 1 cent for lunch, so I think it's a little bit high. Want me to speak to the other? The tax rate as well. The other bill that we're proposing has to do with bringing some equity into the Minnesota Dependent Care Credit. This is a program for low-income families who have children of their own that they're paying someone else to help care for their child. This credit helps reduce some of the high cost of care out there in Minnesota. For full-time care, a parent can expect to pay somewhere between $4,500 to $15,500 a year. This credit helps reduce some of that burden for parents. The credit for parents, a parent is eligible if the child is under age 13. This bill was amended many years ago to include family child care providers who are caring for their own children in their home, but their own children would only be eligible up to age 6. The idea being that a provider who's caring for her own child is not paying for child care, but that child is taking up a space in the licensing rules and therefore cannot be earning money for that space. And so we make it a little bit better for them to be able to claim this credit, even though they're not paying for child care. But the limitation, again, is for a child up to age 6. So this bill would raise that age to the age of all other children for parents up to age 13. I think by doing this, this would also provide more incentive to parents staying home with their own children. They get a better credit for that. More incentives for providers to stay in business, reducing turnover. More financial benefit for low-income providers. This is a low-income program. In order to be eligible, your family has to be earning less than $34,700 this past year. And I think it provides an additional incentive to be licensed. This credit is only eligible for those child care providers who are licensed.
Senator Larson, do we have any idea what the A1 amendment costs?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great question. The fiscal note on that is, I think, in process, and we don't have that number yet. I know that that's being worked on.
Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from the committee? Without objection, the chair lays over Senate File 1776 as amended.
Chair and members.
See what comes next. I'll start. Senator Sinha.
Mr. Chair, while Senator Senjum's coming up to present his bill, we were just having a little discussion about how there hasn't been any objections, and I thought maybe I'd start on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was very sorry I brought that up to Senator Scoy. Respectfully asked him not to start now.
On a bill so old, Senate File 393. Senator Sinha, Senate File 393, and you have a delete all amendment?
Yes.
And this is the first committee this bill's been in?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Member Senator Sinha moves the A1 amendment. It's a delete all. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll probably move through this somewhat quickly, and I have got a couple witnesses here. Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 393 is a bill to establish regional investment credits designed to assist the growth and development of small businesses across Minnesota. The bill is somewhat similar to one that Senator Langset presented a couple of weeks ago or so with respect to, in his case, the biotech industry. This is broader than that and focuses on a wide span of potential applications. We've dealt with the amendment. There is a fiscal note, which is no longer, of course, correct given the amendment. And help me, Mr. Nelson, I'm wrong. Where is Mr. Nelson? The fiscal note now probably becomes $6 million because that's the cap on the program. So I think we've taken care of that. Mr. Chair and members, the bill gives the Commissioner of Deed the ability to certify up to 15 regional investment funds and provide certificates up to $600,000 in tax credits. We cap, as I mentioned, the program at $6 million. Approximately 40% of the funds will be located in the seven-county metro area, the additional 60% in greater Minnesota, the emphasis on business less than 50, and the thrust is in the area of manufacturing, processing, assembling products, research and development, and other incubator kinds of applications that exist out there. It does include, exclude rather, business or service kind of business applications. To move along, Mr. Chair, I've got, let's just start with Steve Mercel. Steve is involved in this kind of thing professionally, and he has a few comments to make with respect to the bill.
Chairman and Senators, thank you very much for letting me testify. My name is Stephen B. Mercel. I'm the CEO of Rainsource Capital. We're located at 1600 University Avenue in St. Paul. I'd like to thank you for letting me testify on behalf of the bill. Our organization is a 501c3 corporation with a mission to build capacity for making equity investments by forming and operating a network of equity funds in areas that are underserved by the traditional equity capital markets. Rainsource Capital builds local capacity to make equity investments in local businesses by organizing what we call RAIN funds in communities. RAIN funds are a series of formal investment funds that pool the intellectual and financial resources of accredited individuals and institutional investors in a community. RAIN funds provide seed and growth equity capital for emerging companies in these communities. Currently, Rainsource Capital has established 21 RAIN funds in 5 states, representing approximately $21 million in capital. In Minnesota, 11 RAIN funds have been established with 200 members and over $8.8 million in capital commitments. These funds have made investment commitments of $3.3 million in 31 companies and are currently in the process of analyzing 20 additional investments. An early-stage company typically receives its equity financing from individual investors, also known as angel investors. And angel investors are experienced business people that are willing to put their own money and time into supporting an entrepreneur. Historically, in the United States, angel investors finance more than 10 times the number of firms as institutional venture capital funds. Angel investors provide the bridge to traditional forms of financing. In our RAIN networks, our typical angel investor is a local community leader who is still involved in his or her own business and is looking to invest personal capital in businesses that could provide a financial return as well as a social return. Typically, that social return is creating jobs and just helping an entrepreneur. People who have gone through this process and have built successful businesses like to help others succeed because they know how hard it is. Benefits to having an angel fund in the community include leveraging other financial options for businesses, help attract technology and information service companies, spur entrepreneurship and innovation, helps create and maintain quality jobs, and diversifies the community's economic base. Rainsource Capital has demonstrated the community benefits of this type of program in a 2004 survey of our companies showed that wages paid and benefits were about $50,000 per employee, the company's finance employed approximately 30 people per company. However, barriers exist for entrepreneurs raising capital from angel investors. Angels are difficult to locate because most prefer to remain anonymous. Often, angel investors lack sufficient time and expertise to fully evaluate a technology or opportunity. Individually, angel investors lack the capital to fully support the growth of a startup company. Multiple investors means multiple terms and multiple agreements. Poor agreements hinder the ability to raise money in the future. As businesses raise investment capital, the first money in usually comes from family and friends of the entrepreneur. The small group will usually provide up to the first $500,000 of funding. The next rounds of capital, $500,000 to $5 million, are provided by investors outside friends and family network. Traditionally, venture capital firms would provide this round of capital. Over the past 10 years, as venture capital has grown in size, these firms have abandoned seed and early stage investing, leaving a gap in the market for entrepreneurs. Industry data clearly shows this decline in early stage investing. In 1987, 18% of all venture capital funds investment went to seed and early stage market. In 1997, the percentage of funds invested in this stage fell to 8%. By 2005, the percentage had fallen to 3%. To fill this investment gap, angel investors and angel investment funds have taken steps to fund promising companies to a point where venture capital firms are willing to invest their capital. As angel investors become more skilled at investing, our firm is seeing a national trend toward formalizing angel funds into legal entities to more efficiently deploy their capital and expertise. We support Senate File 393, which stimulates the formation of angel funds in Minnesota for the following reasons. Equity capital will be identifiable and available to entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs will have access to many investors through a manageable process allowing for timely closing of agreements. Funds will enable angel investors to leverage capital expertise and time, resulting in a thorough investment process. Funds will remove the confusion and delays caused by multiple investment terms and multiple agreements. Fund will encourage and create local ownership, local management, and local decisions. Funds will be sustainable investment funds that outlive the benefit of the tax credit. I'd like to just talk about a quick example of a company in Minnesota that has successfully sought and continues to seek access to angel investors, a company called Abbeymore Medical in Parkers Prairie, Minnesota. Abbeymore Medical was funded by the Rainsource Capital and other angel investors since its inception in 1998. The company has raised approximately $16 million to develop its medical device and bring it through the FDA approval process, which they just received last December. Today, the company employs 25 people in Parkers Prairie at wages well above the median. John Reed, the founder of Abbeymore, has stated that without the angel investors, Abbeymore would not have been able to survive and grow. I'd like to give you a little aside. I sit on the board of directors of this company. After we received FDA approval, we needed to go out and raise approximately $10 million of capital to commercialize the device. And we were being entertained by VCs, went out to the VC market, and they would not consider putting in less than $20 million in the company. We had a term sheet from a VC that we thought it was not in the best interest of our shareholders to take for a number of terms. One of those terms was they wanted to move the company. We had an alternative, so we could say no to that term sheet because we could go back to our network and raise money. We raised over $6 million in about a month from essentially this angel network of funders. So these angel funds and angel investors have become more sophisticated, and being able to share deals and aggregate deals around the network is an important element of this. Additionally, angel investors are also going to play an important part in coming ownership transitions for companies owned by the baby boom generation. As these business owners retire, Angel investors can provide equity capital to keep these companies operating in the communities. We believe that these opportunities will increase in the next decade based on opportunities we see today. In conclusion, Senate File 393 will provide a catalyst to form locally based equity funds in Minnesota. The bill is an important part of the state's economic growth by providing an incentive to angel investors to form funds, which will provide more capital to promising businesses that are looking for needed capital in all areas of Minnesota. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I also have, and your time is precious, preciously short. Maybe Mr. Meter, though, can just offer a couple of comments, and I understand that we need to move along.
Mr. Chair, my name is Ken Meter, and professionally I run a nonprofit organization called Crossroads Resource Center, and I'm here as a representative of as a board member of the Hiawatha Fund in southeast Minnesota. We organized our fund for very compatible reasons, but slightly different reasons than the previous speaker. We understand that our region has 90% of our businesses are smaller than 20 employees, and we really need some capital targeted to the needs of these very small community-based firms. I was joined here this morning by Dean Harrington, who's a banker from Plainview, a town of 4,000, and he unfortunately has a bank examiner in the bank today and had to go back to Plainview to meet with them. But he's been looking at the local economy of his bank. He's a third-generation banker, identifying a need for $18 million of capital in addition to what his bank and other banks can provide for about 50 businesses that are steady state. They're not growing rapidly, but they do need capital. A lot of them are leveraged to the hilt. They need some equity investment that can be patient and help them either stay locally owned, help them thrive as locally owned firms, and to really be a kind of continue to be the lifeblood of our economy in the region.
Chair and members, I also have Jeff Nelson from Deed if there are any questions.
Senator, I'm just kind of wondering. I realize this isn't a refundable credit, but on page 3, we allow that credit to be rolled forward on line 3.6 for up to 15 years. I mean, so essentially isn't that an awful long time to make that credit available?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to refer that question to anyone that can answer that. Can you help me?
What's the rationale for 15 years? Why not 8?
Chair and committee, my name is Jeff Nelson. I work for the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. We've been working both with Senator Senjum and with Representative Welty on this bill. Our original bill did call for 10 years of tax carry forward if necessary, and I think we'd be more than willing to make a change from 15 down to 10 or whatever number the committee appears appropriate.
Mr. Chair, my question is on a different area if you want to continue
go
on
ahead.
With this. Senator Senjum, I'm looking at lines 131 through 133. The business should strive to pay wages and benefits. I'm wondering if we shouldn't, you know, make that a little, well, I think we should, they should pay wages and benefits. And then if we need to, we could look at this 175% of federal poverty and see what that number is, and if that it wouldn't be something that the committee should be looking at.
Well, Senator Scott, I think for starters, the problem on line 1.31 is there is no requirement to pay even the minimum wage because it says a business should strive to pay.
Yeah, so we should.
I think that's, I don't know.
Chair and members, that's certainly one that Representative Welty and I struggle with. I think we went back to our hometown people and they thought that, you know, in a smaller community, the strive is perhaps more appropriate and fits better to, to a small town rural America than the must.
Well, and this bill is introduced, Senator Scoy said must.
Right.
And Mr. Chair, do either one of the witnesses know what the 175% of federal poverty level is?
The 175% would require a hourly wage of approximately $18.15. The reason we spoke with the sponsors about changing the must to a strive is that many of these small emerging businesses really aren't paying some of their employees anything at all. Often they're taking equity interest rather than receiving a wage, or as in the case of Mr. meters businesses that he works with, a lot of times it's family members, it's sons, daughters, and to be forced into paying $18 and whatever cents per hour just wouldn't be workable.
Well, but Mr. Nelson, why, instead of changing must to strive, if $18 is a problem, why didn't we just take the 175 maybe down to 150% of the poverty line or 130% of the poverty line or something that was, rather than just open up the floodgate and have no criteria?
Again, we just thought it would be more applicable to try to be flexible to try to help these businesses to start out. We believe that if this bill is to pass and we do a study of the businesses that do qualify for this, we'd be willing to track the wages that are paid and report back to this committee next year and give you an idea of the success and the wage rates that are being paid. And
if there's Mr. Nelson, I got to tell you, if the department participated in this delete all amendment and supported this change, they're not doing their job. Okay, you can pass that along to former Representative McElroy from me. That I think is an unacceptable change for most of us. I mean, if the 175 is too high in some rural communities, I understand that. I mean, even the job Z only has 110 in it. I mean, I get that. But to have no requirement to pay any wage threshold, I think the department's headed in the wrong direction. If I heard you right, said that you participated in working on this bill. But Senator Scoy.
And, Mr. Chair, with regard to the equity, I mean, they could have, you know, the equivalent of the wage inequity if they wanted to do something like that. But I agree with you. I think that we should have some pretty good idea what's going to be here in this area.
Chair and members, just to be sure, Representative Welty and I were elbow deep into this, and the strive is simply a function of what was mentioned here in terms of wages in rural Minnesota and those situations that were mentioned. So, but right or wrong, we shoulder the final decision on this language.
Well, I mean, I like the idea, but I don't like the idea that the only protection we have when we invest $6 million of state money is that people get the minimum wage. I don't think any of us want that, and I think we need more protection than that. And I don't think the department's doing very, very due diligence when they work on something and bring us an amendment that says that.
Mr. Chair, we could hold the bill over. We could, we could scuttle the bill. We could try to amend
Senator
it.
Senator Sundrum, I'm for things that will help create economic activity in rural Minnesota. And if tax credits for people who want to invest do that, I'm certainly for looking at that. But I think the way it is today, I think it still needs a little work. So if the department has some time to work with you over the next, you know, 4 or 5 days,
sure,
and we can kind of come up with something a little better in that area, that would be helpful. And then, of course, it all depends on whether we can wiggle into our target or not. Also, but
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to do that. Our objective is to get this kind of a program into place. Do what we need to do to get that accomplished.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Scott.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd recommend that we do lay this over for possible inclusion, and let's give Senator Sundrum some time to work on this and see where we can come up with it. Because I generally am supportive of these rain funds. I think they're a pretty good tool for rural Minnesota, but I would like to see some firming up in that area.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
As they work on the language, I don't want to lose sight of the point that Mr. Nelson brought out about folks who receive an equity interest and work on the solution that was suggested by Senator Scoy. Acknowledge that may be the case, but create some sort of equivalency measure.
Well, I think is that the reason for the 75% number? Is to recognize people that are working for equity, Mr. Nelson?
Yes.
And I don't think that's where the problem area is. The problem is with the 75% of the people that are going to get paid. I think, is that
Mr. Chair, I think it might be a little more of a problem because some of these startups, you know, they probably are only starting with four or five people, and they all might be working for equity as they start. And so maybe we should think a little bit more about that as we're working on this provision.
And this is probably a discussion that's probably better had in Senator Metzen's committee than in this one, probably. But Senator Sundrum, I think it's a it's a good idea.
Sure.
I think the department just needs to give a little more thought to requiring some kind of wage threshold. So,
Sure, I'd be happy to. You know, if you want to hold the bill over, we can work on this and try to get back with you.
Okay.
The better language or satisfactory
chair,
language.
Chair lays over Senate File 393 as amended for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
There was no objection.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ma.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. Thank you for allowing us to bring to you Senate File 1894. Mr. Chair and members, this is about retaliatory taxes, and it is really, it's an area that's unique to the insurance industry. And the way that I was trying to explain this to myself is the best way to explain the retaliatory taxes from our state perspective is do unto others as you would like them to do unto you. And the problem is that we have and this bill deals specifically with group life insurance, state-owned insurance plans. And the problem we're trying to address is that if you look at the map that's in this little sheet that you have, Minnesota is yellow. And when Minnesota goes to the blue states to sell state-owned insurance plans, the blue states impose a premium tax on Minnesota companies that do business in the blue states. And that's because they will charge Minnesota companies what Minnesota imposed on them at home. So what this bill is trying to do is to say that when the blue states come to Minnesota, we will treat them like blue states, so that when Minnesota goes to the blue states, they'll treat Minnesota companies like a blue company, like a company that's in the blue state. However, Minnesota companies that are in Minnesota will be treated like they're in a yellow state, meaning that we will continue to impose our premium taxes on those policies. So we're, in essence, just saying that if a company is domiciled and the blue states come to Minnesota, we would treat them as if they were in their own state, so we will exempt the insurance premium on that, the tax on the premium, and so that when Minnesota goes to the blue states, we too will be exempt and not impose the tax that we pay here at home. And that's really the gist of the bill. Ms. Leslie Chapman of Security and Financial Group is with me today. If you would like to ask her more detailed questions, she's available to answer questions. It doesn't cost us anything, Mr. Chair and members. The only time when it might cost us if currently Minnesota Life, which is a subsidiary of the Security and Financial Group, if they were to lose the business that we're currently giving them to a foreign company that's from a blue state, but I don't think we'll do that to them. So there's no cost to this. It's just a change to allow our Minnesota companies to be more competitive in other states.
So, Senator Moore, I mean, what is the risk that there is a fiscal cost to this? I mean, when is that contract up?
Minnesota
Life's contract.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members, Minnesota Life has insured the Minnesota State Plan since the 1940s. We've had it for over 60 years. There is no scheduled date for it to come up or go out for bids. That's completely at the discretion of the state to choose that.
Mr. Chair, if there's no other questions or objections from the committee members, I'd like to move that Senate File 1894 be laid over for possible inclusion in the tax bill.
On Senator Moore's motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Bill's laid over for possible
Thank you.
Inclusion.
Thank you.
Senator Langseth.
Mr. Chair, members, back when we had our financial crisis in 2003, one of the many things that were done to help us through that was provision for the state fairs where they would be able to get back money from their ticket sales and the sales tax. I think there should have been a sunset put on that. There was not. And so to get back to where we were does take legislation. It amounts to about $1.2 million. The state will continue to collect about $5 million from other activities in the state fair. But that $1.2 million they were using for capital expenditures, for fixing up their buildings and so on, they no longer have that money. This would simply restore it back to what it was prior to 2003. So at this time, I'll let Jerry Hammer, what do you call yourself, the executive director of the fair or whatever it is, mention a few things about it. Yeah.
Thank you, Senator Langseth. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Hammer. I'm the general manager of the state fair, currently in my 11th year in that position, but I've worked there since high school. Grew up in the neighborhood, been there my whole life. So. The state fair, the Minnesota State Fair, is recognized as one of the premier events in the world. We get visitors from all around the world coming to see the fair, see how it works, and help out particularly with agricultural events in our ag education programs. The economic impact of the state fair is it's in excess of $150 million a year in the Twin Cities. There's additional economic impact outside the Twin Cities as well. As Senator Langseth said, the state fair vendors and other sales at the fair earn about $5 million in sales tax for the state. The state fair also provides the equivalent of about 4,300 full-time jobs, so the economic impact is significant. There's another bottom line, too, in addition to the economic one, and that's the social and the cultural one. Minnesotans take a great interest, a great ownership, great pride in the state fair, and we do our best, the board and staff, to make sure that trust is well placed and that they can be proud of their state. We're in the business of building community. On the flip side of the sheet, you'll see some of the structures. Most of the fairgrounds were built WPA days and earlier. There are a few buildings that date back to the 60s and 70s, but most of them are WPA and earlier. And we're doing the best we can without any sort of appropriation or any aid at all. We take care of the facilities through operating income. And on an annual basis, we'll spend between, in a good year, $5 to $6 million on capital work and just in general maintenance. The return of the sales tax that we were allowed to retain will help. That's not the complete answer. There's other things we need to do as well. But and other things that we have been doing, including the legislature gave us authority to issue our own revenue bonds a few years back, not state-backed, just strictly by our own revenue. So we're doing everything we possibly can to take care of the fair, to make sure that the fairgrounds stay in good shape without seeking any sort of a larger assistance from the state. But the sales tax did help quite a bit. And the language in the bill is identical to the language that was removed from the tax law during the 2003 session. And what it requires the fair to do is to take the foregone sales tax. This is sales tax on admission tickets, on grandstand tickets, and on carnival ride tickets. We're required to match that with additional revenue and then dedicate all of the proceeds to capital work for the fairgrounds.
Senator Langseth, anything further?
I don't believe
Members
so.
Of the committee, Senator Double.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't realize we had done this. And I'm wondering if this has something to do with the decision by the state fair board to kind of let all the trees go. You know, that they, it's not a criticism, but I do know that that was an operational change. All the trees were just kind of, all the elm trees were just kind of left and not taken down. They had a very, very aggressive program. Now all the trees are pretty much gone. The experience at the state fair is, I think, pretty diminished, it, you know, because it's so barren and sun-scorched now. I love the state fair, and I'm wondering if this change will help them get back a hold of the Dutch elm program at the state fair, or aggressively replace the trees that have been lost. Practically all of them have been scoured off the site.
Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. Senator Dibble, the fair, going back to the 70s, when Dutch elm first appeared in the Twin Cities, was very aggressive and maintained that program. When Dutch elm reoccurred a couple years ago, it hit us hard, not because we let them go. We've taken great care of the grounds and our landscape. What did happen was because the fair worked so hard in the 70s to retain the elm trees that we had proportionately far more than the rest of the Twin Cities. So when Dutch elm came back, we had a lot more trees that were affected, but we work very hard on maintaining our grounds and our landscape. And every time a tree comes down, there's no heart that breaks any more than any of ours at the fair.
Well,
but this
Chair.
Would certainly, anything at all that would help us with capital and landscape would certainly help.
Senator.
Thanks. Well, Mr. Chair, well, I'm not criticizing the fair. I mean, you know, resources are what they are. And you know, decisions had to be made. We had a forester who consults with the state fair who told us in committee a couple of days ago that that's what started happening. Was the level of aggressiveness that there was just diminished, and you know the trees were gone. But will this allow you to more aggressively replace your trees so that you can restore some of the shade and improve the experience for folks walking around the fair?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, anything at all that we receive will help us make the fairgrounds a better place. And I must add, we have been very aggressive with reforesting the grounds. We've received some help from Xcel Energy, the University of Minnesota as well. We've had a lot of contact with the U of M. Their forestry department have been working with them. And that's a surprise to me that some forester would say that we somehow let things go. That's news to me.
Well, that's the direct testimony we received, Mr. Chair.
Anything else, members? Chair lays over Senate File 1657 for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Senator Langta, thank you. Ms. Bell, thank you. Anything else, members? Tomorrow morning, 8:30, we're going to have a presentation from the Mall of America about a project that they would like to pursue in Bloomington. Senator Larson, your district?
My district, Mr. Chair. Indeed.
Come with bells on.
I'll be here.
8:30 tomorrow morning, members. This meeting's adjourned.